Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. I'm still getting used to the introduction. And today's Thursday, December 9th. And I see our first guest, Nancy King, is already on the line. So let's welcome her in.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good morning, Nancy King. What a pleasure. We should just quickly introduce you. You're a commentator. You've been on WVOX in New Rochelle. So you've been there for many, many, many years. So thank you for making the time for us today.
Thank you.
You know, what I am thrilled about is that we're going to talk about something that some people may have heard of, and others probably have never heard about it at all. And the discussion is going to be about COVID, long haulers, and the long-term effects of COVID-19. And do you think that people realize that whether you're inoculated or not inoculated against the COVID virus, that you could become a long hauler? And even though you suffer...
They don't realize.
And if you suffer from COVID, normally people think that we will recover in about 2 weeks or so, and you don't carry the virus anymore. You don't test positive for the virus, but you could also be a long hauler and have side effects that go on for weeks and months. And you cannot be recognized to be infected. This is a mind-boggling situation here. What's going on?
Well, it's very funny. I was one of the first here in Pinellas County, March 17th, 2020, to get COVID. Yeah, so that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
Turned myself in to the County Board of Health. Went to bed for a week. It was a rotten virus. But after 10 days, I felt better. I was up. I was moving around. I thought I had made a full recovery. And then 3 months later, I woke up and I was paralyzed from the waist down.
It took 3 months for you to recognize that outcome came about?
3 months for it to happen. Just for it to happen.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And that's the hallmark of long COVID. You think you've gotten out of the woods. It wasn't that bad. And then, you know, I woke up paralyzed. I had to relearn how to walk. I had internal tremors and body tremors and hand tremors. Not to mention the fact that, again, the weird smells, can't taste anything. I still can't taste anything.
Mm.
The insomnia, the auditory hallucinations as well.
Really?
Yeah. This is also new and novel because it is a novel virus. That they just don't know what to do with that. They really don't know what to do with that.
Because I've been reading some stuff from different medical institutions, but they're uncertain about it. They don't understand why it happens.
Nope.
They don't understand all the ramifications. They almost postulate in a positive manner that maybe this will eventually come to an end, and that you won't suffer anymore. But they're unequivocal because they really don't have the information yet.
No, they really don't.
Are they studying long haul?
I was very, very lucky. I have a very aggressive nurse practitioner who got me into a National Institute of Health long hauler study in Tampa.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I've been very lucky to see them once a month. What I have found is they, too, are flying by the seat of their pants. They have no idea what's going on. So you can treat a symptom as it arises. But as far as being able to treat the whole functional human, you can't.
Uh-huh.
You just can't.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you look at your little basket of what they have you on, and a lot of it is vitamins, Zyrtec,
mm-hmm.
and Pepcid as an anti-inflammatory work together. Who knew? Who knew?
Mm-hmm.
The craziest side effects, anxiety. I've never had anxiety in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I have crippling anxiety now.
Really?
Loss of stamina, loss of core strength. It's just been baffling. So this virus is bigger than anything they expected it to be.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Is there a way to prevent long-term COVID, or we don't know yet?
No. No, there is not.
Uh-huh.
And I think what scares me with the Omicron variant and with our numbers going back up are the amount of children who are suffering from long COVID as well.
I didn't realize that it also infects children as well.
Yep.
And is there a difference in their understanding, or there isn't still?
No, they have the same symptoms and signs as the rest of us long haulers. You know,
uh-huh.
It's a little harder to explain to a 5 or 6 or 7 year old or even up to a young teenager what's going on with them. But they are just as
mm-hmm.
sick as we are.
Okay. Mm.
And, you know, the other thing is that I would be remiss not to talk about is the amount of people committing suicide over this.
Yes, I have heard about that as well.
Yeah.
Do you also suffer depression to such an extent you would even consider that?
Very much. Very much.
So how do you pull yourself out of such a state?
You don't. You kind of go with it and you roll with it. I have found the best thing for me to do is to get up, and I am now on full-term disability. That's what the virus did to me. I went from running marathons to having to motor plan to get to my kitchen.
Wow.
The depression is intense. And it's raw. And I'd be lying if I didn't say that I hadn't had several bouts of suicidal ideation along the way.
So is there any hope at the moment for understanding exactly what causes this? And is there any, and is the public being notified? Because I hear very little about long COVID.
I think
doesn't seem to make the mainstream.
Little. We hear very little because obviously we're living in a rapid news cycle that is dominated by politics. And, you know, I've even had people tell me, when are you going to get over this? And I was like, when I can, you know, put on a pair of shoes and walk to the corner, that's when I'll get over it.
Right.
So it's not a story that gathers a lot of traction. You know, you'll get it for a minute
Is it too terrifying? Is it too terrifying for people to become aware of it? Well,
I think it is terrifying for people.
It is. I would think so. I think it's very scary. Is that the difficulty about it all, that it's hard to explain to people that this could conceivably be an outcome? I got to ask you one question that leads up to the second question. Were you inoculated before you got COVID?
March 17th, 2020. They didn't even know what they were doing with vaccines then. I'm 21 months into this.
Oh, my goodness. 21 months.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it, why are we being deficient as a nation and in our, from our medical professionals for not telling people more than, well, you should get inoculated? But do people realize that if they don't get inoculated, they're more susceptible to getting COVID, and therefore, whatever the percentages of people who get COVID, they might also come down with it, and they're going to be debilitated at the moment for a very long time.
I've had it for a very long time. I mean, we're coming up on 2 years.
Yeah.
What do people, you know, I listen to people, and obviously I live in a red state.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm all for vaccine mandates. Mandate the crap out of it. But I still mm-hmm. have friends who say, no jab for me. You're not going to track me. You're not going to do this. I'll never forget a neighbor of mine said, when I first got vaccinated back in April, she said, now you're going to be tracked by Bill Gates. I said, I have a cell phone. I have an iPad. He's tracking me already. Mm-hmm. I said, and as far mm-hmm. as being tracked, I said, you think they put a chip in me? I said, I'm 64. I could wander away from home at any time. They'll scam me like a dog
yeah.
in the palm and send me home. So there.
Do you?
Sadly enough, it's
go ahead.
A very politicized virus.
Become politicized? I didn't realize that.
It's 100% politicized.
So this,
yeah.
the people who don't want to get inoculated are the ones that look down on people who suffer from long-haul COVID?
They don't believe
it. How does that connect? They don't believe? Oh, my God.
They don't believe it.
But aren't there ramifications when you look at people? Do some people lose their hair? Do they lose a lot of weight?
Oh, my God, I lost all my hair.
You're kidding.
I apologize for the dogs. They're painting my landing.
That's okay. You know, they probably want to get in on the conversation.
No, they want this man to leave our picture with
uh-huh.
them.
Uh-huh. Okay.
No, I mean, when all my hair fell out, and it was, that was, mm-hmm. for a woman, one of the worst experiences. But a common thought.
Uh-huh.
So I walked over to the hairdresser. He said, sit down. He picked through my hair like we were monkeys in the zoo, and he was like, sit down. He said, we're taking this all off. We're starting from scratch.
Okay.
And then after it was over, he said, I am definitely seeing plenty of clients with COVID hair loss.
Really?
Yeah.
Are we doing the nation a disservice by not really telling them more about COVID-19 long haul?
Yes, I believe so.
And do you think it is because it is politicized that we don't discuss it, or is it because it's so frightening for people who may just be oblivious to it?
I think
what puts us off?
It's been politicized. It's totally politicized.
Uh-huh.
And,
wow,
you
so
know, I laugh. Obviously, I live in a red state. I live in a red county. And I can't tell you how many people who have Let's Go Brandon t-shirts on.
Mm-hmm.
So they're non-believers. They think
mm-hmm.
that the current president is doing this to them. And it's part of the reason we're all so sick. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't know too many 79-year-old men who could come up with this.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so they won't get vaccinated. You know, I still watch a fair amount of news from New York. You all seem to have it under better control than we do. And yet the numbers are still going up.
Well, the numbers are going up through the roof. This will be this is the fourth wave. They're thinking of it. I know in Israel they have a very, very high vaccine rate, but they're also going through the same cycle. In Europe, they're going through the same cycle as well. And so everyone's in their fourth stage. It's not simply Omicron. This was happening before. I believe that Omicron, the latest aberration or variant, is more infectious, but less virulent as previous. But
yeah,
we don't know
symptoms.
That yet.
Milder symptoms?
Yeah, milder symptoms.
Yeah.
Is there something also wrong with our language? Are we trying to make it seem like, it's okay, don't worry about it, you'll get over it? And yet that's not the reality for a lot of people, especially like
it's
you,
not
for
the
example.
Reality.
And you're
it's
not,
not
so
reality.
Unique in that sense.
No.
Yeah. Do we have a clue of how many people are infected with long-haul COVID?
10 million.
They don't. 10 million?
10 million.
That's like 5% of the country, isn't it?
Yes.
Maybe we're more than 200 million. I don't know.
Yep.
Wow.
10 million.
And you know what's so interesting is that I only heard about COVID-19 long haulers first in the United States, but the most amount of input I was able to read from Germany or from England, and yet I don't hear anything about long-haul COVID from China.
Well,
it's like,
you know, they're good at keeping secrets.
Yeah, evidently.
Very good at keeping secrets. You know, and again, how did the virus get here? Did it? Bat to person transmission leaked out of a lab. I do believe it was leaked out of a lab, but not intentionally.
Yeah, I don't think it was intended.
No. Came out on somebody's shoe or. So, you know, again, this has been an extraordinary challenge and a huge learning curve for me.
Mm-hmm. So what have you learned?
I've learned what I can eat and can't eat. I'm on a low histamine diet. I never knew that foods contained the amount of histamine they do, but I'm on a low histamine diet. I'm on a vegetarian diet.
And what does low histamine mean? What does low histamine mean and why do you avoid it?
A histamine is an inflammatory. So think about it if you have allergies or and you're sneezing your brains out. Histamine is an inflammatory. So what you have to do is you do an elimination diet and you take down every piece of food that contains histamine. Which leads you to, like, eating cardboard.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
I've given up coffee.
Huh.
I've given up red wine. Anything that's going to act as an inflammatory, I cannot even look at. And there are certain, as a vegetarian, there are certain, you know, vegetables I can't eat. I can't eat spinach anymore.
Why? Yeah. It also has histamine?
Very high in histamine.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so you really have to restrict what's causing your body to inflame. Nothing that even resembles soda or a can of Coke. Yeah, it's
Seltzer water is no good either? Seltzer water, no good either?
I drink water, but it has to be electrolyte infused.
Okay.
Because, you know, I spend a good chunk of my time dehydrated because I also spend a good chunk of my time vomiting.
Well, see, when you vomit, you know, it's like hurling. How much do you have in your system anyway? seems like you have such a limited diet.
I ate three tater tots yesterday and sent them back because they were overcooked. But at 5:30 this morning, I was projectile vomiting into my paper towel, and I was like, let me take a look at this. And I was like, it's definitely tinged with blood. So I've also developed a hiatal hernia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there are so many things people don't know about this, and yet they don't want to get the doggone vaccine. Get the vaccine already.
Mm-hmm.
Get boosted already. But, you know,
because
people are going to be people.
We have so many more people who are getting sick.
Yeah. And, of course, I'm down here in Florida, and nobody wears a mask down here. Nobody. Nobody.
Uh-huh.
You'll never see a person with a mask on.
That's also politicized, too?
Yeah.
How do we get to this point of politicizing it? That's what's amazing.
You know, I've talked with a couple of good friends. If the previous president had just come out and said, wear a mask, get a vaccine, I don't think we'd be here. I don't think we'd be here.
So that's, a lot of people are suggesting that, too. That's right.
Yeah.
I've heard that said quite often.
Yeah. You know, and we have a governor down here who wants to run for president. He's all over the country fundraising. And it's sort of like Nero fiddling while Rome is burning.
Yeah.
And, you know, he will find school districts who won't, you know, enact a mask mandate. He'll find businesses over 100 who are vaccinating their employees. And, you know, in the meantime, here's a segment of the population. We're all sick, Ron.
Mm-hmm. How, you know, there used to be a time when, you know, you were attracted to people because of their personality, the way they looked, the way they dressed, becoming aware of what school they went to or if they were involved in government or not in government or they were, somebody in accounting or so many different reasons. But has that all been eclipsed by the politicization of COVID and being inoculated, not being inoculated? Is there a divide that's happening in the country?
Yes, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I mean, I look at it on Twitter. I have a fairly large Twitter account.
Okay.
Including some crazy conservatives. And they're like, no, do not comply. Do not get the jab. And now they're telling people, if you think you feel sick, gargle with Listerine. It will kill the bacteria. I'm like, what?
Mm-hmm.
What?
Well, I guess it must be a run on Listeria.
Listerine, rather. Listerine is expensive, too.
Yeah, it is.
You know, I'm just kind of laughing, but it's not, it's like a pathetic laugh that people just don't get it. Somebody said to me yesterday, why don't you smile and show more teeth and really be happy? And I was like, I woke up today. Good enough reason to be happy.
Yeah.
Because some days I'm not sure I'm going to get up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when you have excruciating pain, you can't get up.
Yeah. So how do you push yourself beyond the pain and the fatigue and even the depression? How do you get beyond that? You must have an unbelievable institution.
No, you just live with it. The depression, I have to make a little list of everything I want to do during the day, and that means something as mundane as scooping the litter box. The pain, I have found that 2 Advil and 2 aspirin as a chaser will alleviate the pain.
Mm-hmm.
You do find certain ways to handle it.
Yeah.
But there are certain things that, you know, no matter what you do, you're going to hurt all damn day long.
Yeah.
I mean, I've laughed.
Do you have difficulty going to sleep? Are you in pain when you go to sleep?
Yeah.
So you wake up in pain and you go to sleep in pain?
You only get between 3 and 4 hours of sleep a night.
Oh, my. So you must have lost a tremendous amount of weight, too, no?
I've lost weight. Nothing appeals to me. Nothing appeals to me. The thing that
mm-hmm.
I can tell you I'm sufficiently living on is macaroni and cheese.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Not
never
exactly.
Thought of it. So does it? No, it may not be healthy, but at least gives you some sort of calorie intake.
It gives you some sort of calorie intake. And, you know, I'm on a probiotic that hopefully
mm-hmm.
will help with the vomiting and the pooping.
Okay.
But, you know, again, people don't want to, in the press, don't want to talk about this because it's an ugly, ugly long-term virus.
Mm-hmm.
Ugly.
Well, there's no feel-good situation about this. It's an
no.
absolute horror.
Yeah.
So who is talking about it? You know, of course you are, but I'm talking about, are institutions talking about it? How do even people learn about it?
Well, the only ones who are really kind of talking about it is Dr. Collins and Dr. Fauci.
Yeah.
And Dr. Walensky.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're in the holiday season. People don't want to hear about it.
That's true, too. Are we listening
yeah.
to people like Fauci, or we're trying to
well,
undermine him left and right?
They're trying to undermine him tremendously. I have a friend who sells a multi-level marketing diet supplement.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not the brightest girl I've ever met. And she says to me, if you take this Optavia, I could cure you. And I said, is your last
mm-hmm.
name Fauci? No. Do I need to lose weight? No. I said,
that's amazing.
And it's $400 a month for powder that you put in water. I was like, go peddle this elsewhere. But I've also had people who saw how really sick I was through the backyard to go to the store. And, you know, rather than sometimes use the walker, I use my little shopping cart to steady me.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And this guy said to me, you should just come out here on the pool deck and open your legs and let the sun shine into it. And I was like, oh, my God.
Sounds like you got
God.
A TV routine down there in Florida.
Oh,
that's
Florida
amazing.
Place ever.
Oh, my God. I would think you'd be laughing all day long if it wasn't so serious. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, listen, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our segment. I look forward to
Alrighty,
speaking to you next
it was a
week.
Pleasure being on. And
it's my
again,
pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Tell your listeners it's out there. Get vaccinated. Get vaccinated.
Absolutely. Well, I think your telling them is more powerful than my telling them.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Be well.
Thank
Take
you for
care.
Having me.
Bye. Bye. Okay, well, that was Nancy King, just a wonderful human being for even sharing all this information with us. Bear with me a moment now. I'm going to try to get a hold of David Rubin. David Rubin is an author, and we've spoken to him before. He used to be the mayor of Shiloh, or Shiloh, depending on how you want to pronounce it. He's in Israel, and so I'm trying to ring him up. Sometimes takes a little bit of time to get through on the number, so we'll just have to wait and see a moment. Oh, there it is ringing now.
Shalom.
Hello, David.
Hagatem leKeren Shiloh LeYaldei Yisrael, Nala Yisheh Hoda'ah. Hello, you've reached the Shiloh Israel Children's Fund. Please leave your message.
Okay. So he's at another number, so I'm going to call him there. And bear with me a moment as I try to get that done. Bear with me a second. All right, let me see if I can get that there. Okay, sorry about that. We used to talk to him quite often, but I had two numbers for him. And so for whatever reason, I picked the wrong one. And so we'll get to him in a moment. Bear with me a second as I put this in. The only thing that I did today that was smart is I put in all the phone numbers for people, so that I wouldn't mess up somehow. Okay, so it'll take us a little bit of time to ring that in. Okay, bear with me. That didn't seem to work somehow. One second. Let's see if this works. Okay, let's see if this one works. Bear with me a moment. Okay, for some reason, you never can tell. Sometimes there are issues. Okay, looks like we're dialing this time, and hopefully that'll go through. It takes longer to get to halfway around the world, even by telephone. Okay. It's not connected yet. It's not yet connected. Okay, well, hopefully we'll get there very soon. Okay, looks like we're...
Shalom, hagatem leKeren Shiloh LeYaldei Yisrael, leDavid Rubin, Na LeAshir Hodah. You have reached the Shiloh Israel Children's Fund and David Rubin. Please leave your message.
Okay, I'm going to call him on the other number. For some reason, this is not working. We'll check one more time, and hopefully we'll be able to reach him. Maybe I accidentally put in the wrong number. One second. Or maybe it's conceivable that both numbers that I have for him actually ring at the same number. Okay, let's hope this works. If not, then we're just stuck without it. Okay. Oh, boy. Usually when you ring locally, it doesn't take so long. But I guess it's, 15 seconds to 30 seconds just to be able to ring in. Okay, let's see what happens.
Shalom.
Hello, David.
Hagatem leKeren Shiloh LeYaldei Yisrael, Na LeAshir Hodah.
Good time.
Hello, you've reached the Shiloh Israel Children's Fund. Please leave your message.
Okay, it looks like both numbers are reaching the same recording. So we're not going to be able to speak to him today. I don't know if he's able to call us up from his end, but just in case, the number is 347-205-9201. That's the number to call in the radio show. So 347-205-9201. Anyway, we'll say goodbye to David and move on. Bear with me a second. Okay. All right. So let's see what we can do here. Bear with me a moment. We were supposed to talk to him from 10:30 to 11, and then I was going to do a segment with you from 11 to 11:30. And then we're going to end up speaking to Lee Williams from 11:30 to 12. Okay, so let's just see if we can move this forward, and we'll see how the broadcast works, and I'll keep checking after every story just to make sure in case we get a call in from David Rubin. So bear with me a moment here. And where are we? Okay. All right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to move into some international items, which you'll find interesting. All right. Well, this is really very interesting. Evidently, America's made quite an impact. France will not join the. Evidently they're not. I thought France was going to join the boycott of the Beijing Olympics, but it's not. France is seeking a common European Union stance. France will not join a diplomatic boycott by other Western countries of the 2022 Winter Olympic Games in China's capital. That's what Jean-Michel Blanquer said today. He's the education and sports minister. The foreign minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, said that Paris was still seeking a common European Union stance on the issue. So the United States, Australia, Britain, and Canada have announced that they will boycott. France said it won't do it. I don't understand the efficacy of it. It just doesn't make sense. But I guess those are the sensibilities in France. So it just is what it is. This is very, very interesting. On an international stage, the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, arrived in Qatar for the first visit since the end of a blockade. Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Mohammed bin Salman, arrived in Qatar on Wednesday as part of a Gulf tour, marking his first visit to the country after his two sides severed ties 4 years ago. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain cut all links with Qatar in June of 2017, alleging it backed radical Islamist groups and was too close to Riyadh's rival Tehran, allegations Doha, the capital, had denied. But relations were fully restored in January after a landmark summit in the Saudi desert city of Al-Ula, and Crown Prince Mohammed was greeted by the Emir of Qatar, Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, with whom he will hold talks, said the official Saudi press agency. This tour comes while a flurry of diplomacy occurs to resolve regional disputes, especially with Iran and Turkey. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was in Qatar last week, or rather this week, for 2 days of talks. Ankara, the capital of Turkey, and Doha had become economic and political partners in recent times with Erdogan's government, notably back in Doha during the Saudi-led boycott of Qatar. Turkey, which is reeling from a fresh economic crisis and is searching for foreign investment and trade, has sought to rebuild relations with former rivals in the Gulf, including the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. There have been signs this year of a thaw between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which have held several rounds of talks since April aimed at improving ties. Well, simmering tensions between Ankara and Riyadh escalated after the 2018 killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the kingdom's Istanbul consulate. Evidently, the Khashoggi affair, the arrest of a man in Paris on Tuesday, suspected of being involved in Khashoggi's murder, had threatened to overshadow Prince Mohammed's Gulf tour, the Crown Prince's global image was tainted by the killing of Khashoggi, who had been a critic of Saudi authorities. But France on Wednesday released a Saudi man bearing a passport in the name of Khalid al-Otaibi after realizing he was not the same individual wanted on an arrest warrant issued by Turkey. Well, Prince Mohammed arrived in Doha after a visit to the United Arab Republic, where he met with Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed and attended the site of Expo 2020. Bear with me a moment. I want to go back to our screen. No, he hasn't called. We'll find out from him in a bit. But France on Wednesday released a Saudi man. I told you that. And security was tight at the expo, where the lavish Saudi pavilion was closed to visitors and a small crowd of onlookers, including women in black robes, gathered outside. Saudi songs, including one with the lyrics, Welcome Mohammed, were played on the loudspeaker at Al-Wasl Plaza, the site's central avenue, or rather venue. The two countries released a joint statement on Wednesday, saying they were committed to enhancing the unity and stability of the Gulf Cooperation Council, which includes Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, and Qatar. So Prince Mohammed has sought to position himself as a champion of modernization and reform, even as his international reputation took a hit from the Khashoggi murder. Crown Prince has said he accepts Saudi Arabia's overall responsibility but denies a personal link with the kingdom, saying it was the work of agents who had gone rogue. Okay, something to recognize. Now, all right, we're at it again. Let's see if I can get a hold of David Rubin. I'll try this number first, and then I'll try the other. Those are the only two numbers. Oh. Well, those are the only two numbers I have. Okay. Let's see if it rings. If we hear the recording, I'll just simply hang up again.
Shalom. Higatem lekeren shilo liyaldei Yisrael. Na leishir hoda'a.
Okay, we're going to hang up on that because that's not the right number, or rather, he's not picking up. Maybe something has happened and he's just not able to do so. Bear with me a moment. Okay, see if I can get this. All right, we'll try this other number. Okay. Well, if we do get through, we may not be able to speak to him beyond 11 o'clock because that was his scheduled time frame. We'll find out because I can always extend it beyond 11 if he gets on. Oh, goodness. There is always something to make things exciting, but we'll see. Hello, David?
Yeah. Hi, Kazi.
David, how are you? I was having
okay, you called me early.
Hold of you.
You wanted to make sure that you can get a hold of me.
Well, evidently, yes. So did I make a mistake at my end? I thought you were going to be on later. So
yeah, 6 o'clock. Yeah, at 11 o'clock your time.
Okay, so is it too soon to begin with you, or can you get started? I don't know.
Well, if it's a recorded interview, I don't mind.
Oh, yeah.
I don't mind doing it now.
Definitely. Okay, that would be great, and that would really be terrific. Well, I should tell people, first of all, that we're talking to David Rubin. He is, as is noted, a trusted voice of Israel. And we're going to talk to him about a book that he recently published. I haven't spoken to him since he published this book. It's called Confronting Radicals, What America Can Learn from Israel. So I haven't read the book yet. I've got to get it so I could be a little bit more up to snuff next time we speak. But what are some of the issues that America can learn from Israel that evidently it doesn't know how to do or doesn't do as well as Israel with regard to confronting radicals?
Well, look, first of all, let me just give a little bit of the background of
how the book
came about. I live here in Israel, and I was watching what was going on in America. And frankly, I was shocked by the extent of what appeared to be a revolution against American values, and when I say American values, you know, I'm not even talking about the values of the Christian right, the religious right. I'm talking about values that almost every American would agree are central to the United States. For instance, free enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we saw happening a year and a half ago was against free enterprise, was against the free market, the looting of stores, the boarding up of Macy's department store in Herald Square in New York City, and store after store after store after store. It was just shocking. And people here in Israel were asking me, what is going on over there? What is happening in America?
Because you have Brooklyn roots, right? Your roots are originally from Brooklyn.
Well, yeah, that's why people were asking me, yes. They know
right,
that I'm
right.
an American citizen. They know that I grew up in New York. And, yes, I've been living in Israel for over 30 years. But they, sure, that's why they were asking me. And they know that I'm, very astute observer of what's going on in America. And I identify with it, and I didn't move to Israel because I was running away from America. I moved to Israel because I wanted to be part of the great enterprise that is Israel. But I still feel connected to the United States, very connected even to this day. And I believe that the United States is a great country where anyone can achieve almost anything if he or she really works at it. And I know that those people, and many of them were among the so-called George Floyd protesters, who want to bring down those values and want to do away with the United States as a Judeo-Christian civilization where freedom and aspiration are central to what America is.
Well, do you think that the George Floyd incident has been taken beyond its original context? Why has it become like a central point for a diminution in the values that America held for itself in the past?
Well, it's been that way for a long time. If you think back to the marches of Al Sharpton, going back a number of years, this has been going on, actually a lot of years when you think about it. I mean, Al Sharpton, who went to Tilden High School in Brooklyn, which is where my brother
went. My
cousin
went to Tilden, actually.
Okay, there you go. There you go. So my brother told me that he remembers Al Sharpton. He was just like a rabble rouser and just making trouble and big racist and going after everybody, trying to create havoc. Well, he's been doing that for a lot of years, and then a lot of people started following him. Unfortunately, race is often a pretext for those who want to create bedlam, that want to create anarchy. And that's what I saw happening with the George Floyd riots. Those who want to create anarchy, the anarchists from New York City, who have spread their wings throughout a lot of the major cities in the United States, were trying to create anarchy. Because anarchy creates a vacuum. And history has shown us that when you have a vacuum, that something always comes in to fill the vacuum, and it's usually not very good. So one thing that we can learn from Israel about that is that you have to have a sound value system, and you have to have a consensus. And then once you have that consensus and value system, you have to defend that value system. Otherwise, it's going to fall apart. Because those who are ideological, those who believe in the rightness of their cause, whether it's a good cause or a bad cause, are the ones who are going to win out in the end. And the left-wing radicals have been at it for several decades now, and since the 1960s and the 1970s, really, when they ostensibly went establishment, they have been working behind the scenes through the education system to change America. And unfortunately, they've been succeeding.
Well, what is it that America doesn't recognize? It's just been an insidious creep along over all these years, and America doesn't get it? Or are we now divided along those lines?
America doesn't get it.
The battle doesn't get it. Okay.
America doesn't get it. I mean, they're starting to, but they really don't understand. You know, it was done behind the scenes, very quietly. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone's looking at the president. Who's elected president, right? Obama got elected president, and then Trump came in, and then Biden, and back and forth. But that's important. I'm not saying it's not. But what's really important is people who quietly go about their business at the grassroots level, changing the educational system. It's not an accident that today you have an overwhelming majority of Democrats with a capital D in the professorships. You know, we're talking like 90% of supporters of the Democratic Party in the professorships in American colleges and universities. Why is that? It's because that effort has been made in recent decades to pack the colleges and universities with like-minded people. So the American College and University, which in the past had been this great marketplace of ideas where people could discuss and disagree and you know, learn together, it's changed. It's become this this monotone. It's become this place where any sort of dissent from that left-wing secular norm is either violently assaulted or is silenced in other ways.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't look that if it took so many years to change the dynamic and the people at the top of the school food chain and the teaching process, it doesn't look like it'll ever change. Because do we have another 40 years to wait through another transition to go back? Is America ready to go back?
America has to go back.
It's become very violent.
One thing I have to say, and I want to emphasize this very strongly, is that there is no change that is not irreversible. There is no change that is irreversible. And change can always be reversed. It is always possible. Mm-hmm. And to understand that, we can look at one of the chapters in my book, Confronting Radicals, What America Can Learn from Israel, mm-hmm. which is the chapter that deals with Israeli socialism. Now, Israel, the modern state of Israel was started as a socialist country.
Right.
It was found, which is incredible, knowing, you know, as an American Jew, that in America, Jews were in the forefront of free enterprise. You look at so many of the department stores and you know, specialty shops and electronics stores. They're all owned by Jews. They're all founded by Jews. They're all started by Jews. And,
right.
You know, and, you know, sometimes Jews being on Wall Street is like a slur. It's used as a slur by the far left. But the mm-hmm. fact is that the Jews have accomplished tremendously in the free enterprise system. And it's through hard work and nothing else. And very often it was...
Was in Israel, was it different because it was a very young country and a lot of Russians came there, brought the socialism with them?
Yes. Well, at that time, it was the Soviet Union. And
yeah.
a lot of the founders of Israel were influenced by the early idealism of the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
of the socialist system there. And
yeah.
they came, they brought it to Israel, and that's why you had the kibbutzim, the agricultural
mm-hmm.
communities, and
yeah.
they were so widespread in the early part of the state of Israel in the early years.
Mm-hmm.
But socialism became ingrained in the Israeli system, and you know, so people who look at Israel today. And they see the, you know, the tremendous preponderance of high tech, the success of
yeah.
Israeli high tech, and the success of Israeli entrepreneurism, and mm-hmm. and the disproportionate amount of Israeli businesses on the New York Stock Exchange,
mm-hmm.
the you know they, this all comes from. Israel's involvement in free enterprise. So if you look back, you look at Israel today, you would never know that it was a communist nation or a socialist nation, more accurately.
Right.
It was democratic socialism. And so, yes,
so
people always...
So that's the change that you say can happen. You're saying that that's the change that can happen.
Yeah, it's look, there was always...
It's just the stage. Mm-hmm.
Just the stage. Look, there was always... always the right to vote, but it was a socialist system. Now,
mm-hmm.
if you look back at that time of, you know, first couple of decades of the State of Israel from 1948, really all the way through till 1980, I guess we're talking like three decades,
mm-hmm.
Israel was socialist. There was one health fund, and you had to belong to that health fund. There was one
right.
television station, only
mm.
one television station. It was owned and controlled by the Israeli government. And there was one labor union.
Mm.
And it was also controlled by the Israeli government. So when you don't have any sort of competition, when you don't have any sort of private initiative, then it's going to hurt your economy badly, and it did. By
mm-hmm.
by the year 1980, Israel had inflation of several hundred percent. The growth rate was very small, very low, and that's even in a country which had a lot of immigration,
mm-hmm.
Legal immigration, by the way. So it was a big problem, and everyone knew that something had to be done about it. The socialist system couldn't continue. Israel didn't have the capital to absorb all the new immigrants that were going to be coming out of the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union fell. And the prime minister at that time, it was Menachem Begin, and he met with Ronald Reagan, who was president at the time, and he asked him for some assistance, for some loan guarantees, so that Israel could absorb all of those new immigrants to build communities for them, make it possible in our little tiny country for these hundreds of thousands of Soviet Jews to be absorbed into Israel. Reagan, in his wisdom, said, if you want to absorb those immigrants, if you want to get our assistance, you have to open up your economy. You have to do the hard work. Now, Begin believed in free enterprise. He was the first prime minister in Israel who believed in free enterprise. All the others that came before him were socialists. So Begin agreed with it. Begin and Reagan sat together and they made out a plan whereby Israel would open up its economy and do away with socialism. And it worked. It worked. Mm-hmm. It worked in flying colors. So no one can tell me that change is not possible, that change, that harmful, the harmful effects of the grassroots professionalism of the left, that it can't be undone. It can be undone.
So what you're suggesting in your book, or one of the theses in the book, is that change can happen, but at the same time, America doesn't seem to continue its old concept of and acknowledgement of who they are. So they've negated who they are.
Exactly.
And now we have to turn back. So like you said, there is always a possibility of turning back, but is America interested at the moment, or are we just on so many battlefields internally that we don't know which way to go? Seems like we're confused.
Yeah. Look, there's always been this tendency on the right, to the right of the political spectrum, which includes many centrists. There's always been this tendency to just look at the top and say, okay, who are we going to elect? You know, because people on the right, conservatives, are usually busy working. You know, they have full-time jobs. They work hard. They're busy with their families, their traditional families, and they're trying to hold all that together. So they don't have so much time for all this grassroots action. But it's essential for them to make this time because you're not going to win the battle just by going to the polls on election day. It has to be done on many levels.
Yeah, it sounds maybe a little bit absurd. So is Bennett, the new prime minister of Israel, is he going to be able to help, Biden, by working out a deal that was with Begin and Reagan before? I mean, could we turn the tables around?
Well, it depends on what you're looking at. What are we trying to turn the tables on?
Returning to old American values, which have been somehow gutted in the last, 20 years, maybe more?
Right. Well, look, first of all, we were talking about Reagan and Begin, who saw things in a similar way. They both believed in traditional values. They both believed in the free market economy. They both believed in freedom and liberty.
Great.
They had that in common. Biden, I'm not sure what he believes or if he believes at this point. I don't think he's really in control. He's always been thought of as a working class kind of guy, but if you look at his background and his involvement with China and all these shady deals, I don't think he's such a working class guy. and
yeah.
And he's been espousing all these left-wing views since he became president, because he's looking over his shoulder at, you know, at the left-wing power base in the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so I don't know how much he believes in that free market system anymore. Whereas you know, someone like Bennett, who's a free market entrepreneur, who you know, built his own startup and made millions with it.
Yeah,
I know that he believes in the free market system, but you know, he's kind of handcuffed internally in other ways.
Right. So how can there are lessons to be learned from Israel. By America, but is America interested at the moment? Are they even thinking about looking at Israel as an example for some issues that can satisfy their needs? Or
I know from the response, Hezi, from the response to my book, Confronting Radicals: What American Can Learn from Israel. I know that people notice it and are talking about it, because if Israel has what to offer to America, and Israel has a lot, there's a lot that America can learn from Israel. You could also look at the problem of semantics. In Israel, we've always been confronted with this Muslim propaganda war, where they try to change words, use words to undo things that we know to be true, such as the Palestinian movement, which tries to establish a Palestinian state in the biblical heartland of Israel, in the areas around Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria. They change the semantics. They call it the West Bank instead of Judea and Samaria. They call Jerusalem Al-Quds instead of Jerusalem. They call the Temple Mount by a different name that has nothing to do with the temples. The temples of Israel that stood on the Temple Mount, that's called the Temple Mount for a reason, correct? It's kind of like trying to change the semantics. It's like if the left would succeed in changing the name of Washington, okay, because they believe that, you know, Washington, having been a slave owner, should not be honored. Well, then they would succeed at doing away with that history also, the fact that it's called Washington because of George Washington, who was a great leader, who sacrificed for his country and happened to have slaves because everyone in the world had slaves at that time. But the people who tear down statues are people who really don't understand. They don't understand what those values are all about. They don't understand that the statues are representing great leaders who may have had slaves in their time, but so did the rest of the country have slaves. So those who are attacking and tearing down and canceling are people who do not understand history and do not understand context in history.
So how do we move it back to something that can accommodate both sides, or is that an impossibility? And is that the problem, that we're acquiescing to changes in the reality that was and built America? So how can we do this? What is it? Almost 300 years later.
There are two different value systems. There's a value system. You can try to accommodate everybody, but there is a value system that believes that hard work should not be rewarded, that believes that everyone should have handouts, that believes that gender, there are no gender differences, and that believes that there are no genders, as bizarre as that concept is. And there are those who believe that all white people are bad, that believe that racism is inherent in America if you are white, or if you are not black, for that matter. There's a lot going on. That's a different value system than what America once was. And there are those who still believe in hard work, in connection with God and Judeo-Christian values and the family system of having a father and a mother and taking care of your children and teaching them to be humble. And, you know, these are values that made America great, that a person can work and achieve if he works hard at and whatever it is he's working at. Those are the values that made America great, and those are the values that need to be reinforced in these times, not done away with.
Well, I would agree. At the same time, how is it the new dialogue, or maybe it's not dialogue, but the new rhetoric, is being accepted by so many people all over the world? You know, there's like a pro-Palestinian movement. Of all places in Africa, you know, the Palestinians have never been a friend to any part of Africa. Things like that are happening. And who's taking the lead and saying, no, this is not working?
Well, a lot of that has to do with economics.
Uh-huh.
A lot of it. For many years, we had the Arab oil stranglehold over the West, and certainly over those African countries, which were, you know, which were not developed at all and needed the oil from the Arab world desperately. So everyone would vote the way that the Arabs wanted them to vote at the UN.
Mm-hmm.
What you have happening today, though, is as Israel has become more economically developed and successful, Israel has become the envy of much of the world. And so that's why you have peace breaking out between Israel and some of the Arab countries, because they want to connect with Israel. They realize that Israel is not a force in the Middle East that's trying to take away their freedoms. They realize that Israel is a force for good.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have.
That's going to change the dynamic. Will that change the dynamic? Because it seems like Israel is making relations with countries that before it was unheard of. I mean, it was in a sense really initiated by the Abrahamic Accords. That was, I guess, you know, the weight of President Trump at one time created that, and it still continues to this day.
Yeah, and even now,
relations.
Even now, there are Arab countries that talk about establishing diplomatic relations with Israel. So, some of them are afraid to do so, though, because they're afraid that they'll fall under attack. Whereas when President Trump was president, they knew that they would have his backing and that he would stand with them. And that he was encouraging it.
Yeah. So that made a big difference. I think Israel signed an agreement with Morocco and what is it, in Qatar, I think, too, recently.
Not yet.
A lot of things are changing in the Middle East. Not yet?
Yeah, not yet. The agreement was signed with Morocco with the United Arab Emirates.
Oh, yes.
There are one or two others, but not all of the Arab countries are on board. Some of them are afraid, Saudi Arabia being the most notable, that naturally should sign an agreement with Israel, but but they're not ready to go out on a limb yet. They're a little bit nervous because they have the
their
huge relations country,
are stronger. With Jordan, they're getting a little bit better. I was really shocked to read that Jordan, well, not shocked to read because it's a parched land. They have no water, and Israel desalinates so much water that they're able to sell water to Jordan. And I don't remember what Jordan was going to do in return. They had some sort of a deal. I don't remember what the return was, but they were on equal footing, helping each other. But that's been going on for years, but very, very hush-hush, though.
Right, right. Well, now it's becoming more acceptable. You know, Jordan and Egypt have both had peace treaties with Israel for a long time. And now they are able to say so. They're able to come out with an agreement like that. And not be afraid. And sure, they were criticized anyhow, but you're always going to have some of that criticism in the Muslim world.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And how does Europe sit on all this? Are they also going through their own struggles like America? Similar?
Look, Europe is worse.
Mm-hmm.
Europe doesn't have a strong strong Christian base anymore. They just don't have it. So the United States, at least there's still that strong Christian faction in the Republican Party that's advocating for conservative traditional values. And you have a growing Orthodox Jewish population in the United States as well.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have that in Europe. You know, in Europe you have much more of this left wing secularism that's still dominant, and there's been noticeable change in certain countries, but for the most part, the avowedly secular still rule the day in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amazing. So, how do you feel people are looking with respect to the book? Are you getting calls and say, "Hey, you're on target"? Are you getting any feedback?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. No, the people understand. That when you're talking about these basic lessons that Israel has experienced from our mistakes and our successes, that there's what to learn, and there are a lot of people who want to learn. So some of the things that we've been discussing about the semantics and about the change from socialism to free enterprise in Israel, and unfortunately America's going the opposite way, but it doesn't have to be that way, to quote a great song by Jim Croce. These are times that are very difficult times. It's very difficult to turn back the clock, to reverse change, even if it's bad change. But if there is bad change, then we must turn back the clock. And that's what needs to be done. The whole subject of appeasement, of appeasing radicals, is disastrous. We see it all the time. The defund the police movement. So you may recall during the election campaign, presidential election campaign, Joe Biden said that he's not in favor of defunding the police. There should be a partial defunding of the police. Well, the partial defunding is appeasing the extremists, appeasing the radicals by giving them they want.
So why have we lost our focus? Why do we need to accommodate more people? Is that just simply to appease people? You know, they're not going to be appeased. People believe what they believe. But, you know, if America gives up, you know, its focus and its traditions, what are we left with in America then?
Left with nothing. You have to stand by your values. You have to stand strong and affirm those values and spread the word. Spread the word. Don't be afraid from those who are aggressive. And unfortunately, the radical left is aggressive. We saw it. We saw it in the streets. They are aggressive, and but you can't allow it. You cannot allow that aggression. And those strong, firm values that made America great have to be stood up for.
Mm-hmm. And why are we afraid to do that today? Is it because of a legacy of slavery? But we didn't create it, but have we not given people greater freedom than ever before, whether black or white or green?
Of course, of course. One of the great values of America is the capacity to change, the capacity to improve. And that's also something, it's also a value that comes from Israel. The whole concept of tikkun olam, of the improving of the world.
Well,
and that's a basic Jewish value that is essential for change in America. And so improving the world is something that has to be done. The way to improve the world, you know, the second part of that sentence is tikkun olam b'malchut Shaddai, improving the world in God's name, in God's kingship. And so those values have to be consistent with what God has taught us through his Torah or through his biblical teachings. And I say, well, stand up for that and don't be afraid. Don't be ashamed and stand up for what you believe in.
Terrific. Well, listen, I've kept you longer than expected, so I really appreciate you making the time. My apology for calling you so early. But any last words from you? How is the new book doing?
It's okay. It's okay. The new book is doing great, and I invite people to go to my website, which is davidrubinisrael.com. That's davidrubinisrael.com, and they can get more information about Confronting Radicals or any of my other books on that website, davidrubinisrael.com.
Terrific. Thank you so much. All the best to you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for accommodating me today. Be well. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bear with me a moment. I see Mr. Williams is already on the line. Good morning, Mr. Williams. How are you, sir? Thank you for hanging in there. I'm sorry for the delay picking you up.
Good morning. It's great to be here. Not a problem at all, sir. How are you?
All right. My pleasure. Thanks for making the time. Unfortunately, I had not heard about the Second Amendment Foundation, in which you're very heavily involved in. So for me, this is going to be a learning experience. And maybe you could tell me a little bit more about what is the Second Amendment Foundation and your role in it, because you're also an investigative reporter.
Correct. Well, the Second Amendment Foundation was founded about 40 years ago by Alan Gottlieb, who is and just quite frankly an incredible guy. We have two facets. We are dedicated to preserving the right to keep and bear arms, but more importantly, we're dedicated to educating people about the right to keep and bear arms. Now, we have active litigation in 35 states. I mean, it's difficult for me to keep track of how many lawsuits have been filed here and there, because we are incredibly, in my humble opinion, the most active pro-gun group out there. But I come on the other side. I'm part of the educational side. I have a background as a newspaper man. Before that, I was a police officer. Before that, I was in the Army. And what we try and do is counter some of the mainstream media's misinformation that's out there about mm-hmm. the Second Amendment, about gun owners, and about gun ownership. And if you look at what's going on, I mean, I just wrote a story. There's a troika of groups that want to infringe upon our right to keep and bear arms. That'd be the administration, the mainstream media, and then these anti-gun groups. And we have never faced a more perilous times than now in terms of how our right to keep and bear arms, how, in my humble opinion, our God-given right of self-defense, which is codified in the Constitution, has never been mm-hmm. in such peril.
Why is it that there's a disconnect in the discourse in America? And why is it that so few people understand the Second Amendment? So you have a left-wing, a right-wing battle that's taking place. And how do you fend off, or how do you educate people to the rights that were inculcated into the Constitution that's been presented in the Second Amendment? Why is it that so many people don't know? Why are they averse to knowing?
That's a fantastic question. The whole thing stems from this, you know, this so-called gun debate, which I don't acknowledge. Mm-hmm. For me, the debate ended in 1791 with the signing of the Bill mm-hmm. of Rights. There's no debate. We have a right to keep and bear arms. We have a right to purchase firearms. We have a right to carry them. Government cannot infringe mm-hmm. upon that right. But I've never seen a constitutional right that is under such fire. I mean, if you look at the Bill of Rights, look at all the amendments. Mm-hmm. President Biden said mm-hmm. famously not too long ago that no amendment's absolute. Really? What about the one mm-hmm. ending slavery? What about the one allowing females to vote? What about the one ending prohibition? They seem pretty cut and dried. But for some reason, the second is constantly under fire. And it requires, on the part of Second Amendment watchdogs like myself, like the Second Amendment Foundation, it requires constant vigilance because they're constantly trying to chip away. If they're not coming after guns, they're coming after ammunition. If they're not coming after ammunition, they're coming after an accessory in common use. It requires eternal vigilance.
And what's the intent? Is it to appease people who want to see the Second Amendment nullified? And why are they so emotional about it? And what is the problem with someone carrying a gun?
I think the problem for a lot of politicians is it's not about guns; it's about control. And they want to control the populace. Yes. And mm-hmm. an unarmed populace is much more easy to control than an armed one, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, ask the police, they can tell you that.
Yeah.
For sure.
You don't have to look far. Look at what's going on in Australia right now in terms of the COVID and the rounding people up and that horrible scene mm-hmm. of police firing rubber bullets into a crowd of protesters. I mean, that cannot happen to an armed citizenry. But over there, I mean, mm-hmm. they confiscated firearms years ago.
That's right. So it's conceivable that one's individual rights can be curtailed or totally nullified by a government. And is that one of the reasons that people want to have and do believe they have a right because it's constitutionally guaranteed to carry a gun?
Yeah, I think it's, for me, it's a lot stronger than that. I mean, we are all born
explain
with
that a, then, because I right think well, that's a problem we don't understand.
Right. I my right to self-defense, in my humble opinion and my beliefs, comes from God. I was born with it. I have a right to defend myself and my family. That right just happens mm-hmm. to be codified in the Constitution. My friends who are atheists refer to it as an innate or a natural right that you are born with. I don't care what your mm-hmm. deity de jure is. Most major religions affirm that we have a right to self-defense. Thankfully, that was codified in the U.S. Constitution. But it, like I said, it goes a lot deeper than that for me. mm-hmm. in my humble opinion. And now that I have a right to self-defense, I want the best tools to defend myself and my family. I mean, quite frankly, I make people angry for a living. I take my personal mm-hmm. security extremely seriously. So if I'm right. going to face a threat, I want the best tools to defend myself and my family. And I don't like the government trying to insert itself between me and whatever tool I choose to use. Like, you have a lot of free states around the country who are capped the limit that a firearm can carry at 10 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Having been in a few gunfights, I can tell you, nobody knows how many rounds you're going to be firing, and it's a pretty good feeling to have ammunition left over once the last piece of brass has hit the ground. There's no penalty for mm-hmm. that. So I mm-hmm. want the best tools, and I don't want a government that will tell me or try and limit the type of tools I can use to defend myself and my family. I hope that makes sense.
It does. So the government is trying to limit your rights, and why are they trying to appease the other side of the dialogue, assuming
it is a dialogue? There is no
dialogue
here with the current administration. They are so in bed with the gun banners, with the anti-gun forces, and I'm afraid mm-hmm. taking direction from them. If you look at some of the steps the Biden-Harris administration has taken in terms of mm-hmm. guns, I mean, he came right out during his presidential run saying he is going to take away ARs. He wants to ban ARs. That is the most popular rifle in the United States. I have several. Mm-hmm. Everybody I know has several. For me, in my opinion, it's the best tool for someone to use mm-hmm. to defend themselves. But, I mean, he came right out and said it because he's taken direction and money from those that would strip us of our right to keep and bear arms.
So how do you fight it when so many different institutions want to give the president money in order to earn his favor? How do you change the equation? Go ahead.
Education. I mean, pure and simple. Education combined with litigation. When a local government tries to infringe upon the right, if they don't take a warning, then you sue them. But education mm-hmm. on a national level. I mean, people need to know that, quite frankly, I have found that firearms are pretty nice to have around when you need one. They're kind of like pens in that respect.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the assaults that are going on right now and the conditions in all of these cities that have historically been controlled mm-hmm. by Democrats. I mean, I grew up in Minneapolis. I used to go to Chicago all the time. Chicago, I just loved it. Great city. Now, mm-hmm. You know, we're losing good folks on a regular basis. Yeah, it's so sad. I did stories as an investigative reporter on public housing complexes where guns were banned. If a public resident of a public housing complex was caught with one, they would be immediately mm-hmm. booted out and evicted. I mean, these people were watching drug deals right outside their front door. Their children could not mm-hmm. go outside to play. All the residents told me they were trapped in their homes by crime. A gun is a pretty good equalizer. You know, it would at least keep the criminals out of their homes. And the mm-hmm. stories, thankfully, resulted in these gun bans being overturned. And people now have access to a means to defend themselves. I remember I wrote about this seamstress. Her most prized possession was a Bernina sewing machine. The reason I remember the mm-hmm. brand is my mom had one. She was deathly afraid someone would break into her home and steal it because it was worth quite a bit of money. Mm-hmm. So she had a pistol illegally that would have resulted mm-hmm. in her immediate eviction until we got the law changed mm-hmm. and that she was able to keep it. It's so sad. The people that need them the most are often prohibited and banned from gun ownership.
Yeah, most definitely. But why is it that so many people who don't have a legal gun, like in a place like New York, so many people are running around with guns, and I think that they have more gun power than even the police. How did they get that? They didn't do it legally. Like, you have an AR, you've got it legally.
Correct.
Why is it different and acceptable in New York when the national law is the same?
Well, It isn't acceptable, but it is very commonplace and very, very prevalent. There are 20,000 20,000 gun laws on the books in this country. I mean, let that number sink in. 20,000. And not one of them will stop a criminal from committing a crime. Not one of them.
That's right.
So these criminals, they go out and they get guns the old-fashioned way. They steal them, they trade them, they buy them on the black market with little consequence, especially with some of the later sentences that they're receiving if they're caught with an illegal firearm. We don't, in my humble opinion, need more gun laws. We just need enforcement of the ones that are on the books. I mean, enforcement...
Isn't enforcement police work, but we're trying to undermine the police now.
Right. And they're being completely undermined. I mean, for most of these cops in these major cities, you know, the if they make an arrest, especially for illegal weapons possession, the criminal is out the door before these guys are have finished their shifts because of this light prosecution. I mean, that should be a tough crime. And that is a good way to end some of this gun violence in some of these major cities, is actually start making the arrest for them and then start sentencing these people to crimes. I mean, Chicago is a perfect example. I worked in a gang unit. Chicago has 100,000 gang members in their their gang database. 100,000 gang members. The cops know who they are, but they just can't go out there and effectively crush some crime because the mayor's office and the city officials won't let them. They don't want to see that. I mean, Chicago.
Why not? What is it? Why don't they want to see that? What is it they're afraid of?
Gloves. They want kid gloves on the criminals. Okay. They don't want people going out there and making these arrests because they might be potential voters. Chicago has had a gang unit since the 20s when they were running around chasing this guy named Al Capone. They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
If the city administration would let loose of the reins, that crime problem could come to a screeching halt within a few months. It's got a great police department. So, just got to let them do their job.
So who does it benefit? It benefits government to see this crisis before us, and people who are innocent are getting killed, or
I don't think it benefits government.
People who don't.
I think it harms government. It certainly harms the city. I mean, there's a lot of disinvestment. Would you start a business in Chicago right now and move your employees to that city? Most people would.
So where is the disconnect between one side of the aisle and the other? Why is it that so much of America doesn't appreciate what you're saying? And why is it that so many people that, are comforted by what you're doing legally and in writing and investigating, how is it that we can bring that together, or are we no longer able to bring it together? Because we didn't have this trouble 40 years ago, did we?
No. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest, in the suburbs. Guns are, we have a farm in the family. All my relatives are in agriculture. Yeah. And go and hunt. Guns were just a tool for me. I mean, I don't even remember not shooting. I remember when I was young, I started with BB guns and air rifles and 22s.
Not to kill people.
No,
not to kill
certainly
people.
Not. No, they were used for taking rabbit and deer and pheasant and duck and recreating, clay pigeons and target shooting. And it was part of my culture. I grew up in a gun culture. A lot of folks in a lot of major cities haven't. I mean, the only guns they've ever seen have been illegal. There's no gun culture there. But I think it comes down more on the national level, especially among politicians, on their interpretations of freedom. I mean, guns for me, they represent freedom. An armed man is not a slave. But for a lot of politicians, they're scared of them. They've never grown up with them. I think I'll go back to what I said earlier, and unarmed society is easier to control in their beliefs.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing. Amazing. And do you speak only to one type of reader and to one type of individual that belongs to the Second Amendment Foundation? and so many others are just not interested or just turn their nose up at what you've got to say, or is there any discourse going on? I'll be honest with you, I have never spoken to anybody like you before. And well, I don't know what that means necessarily, because I don't know you from a hole in the wall. And so it's not like I'm making a judgment call about your ethics or any other standards that you have, or if you're good looking or ugly, or if you dress well, or you're well educated or not. I don't want to burden myself with all those things, because I'm just trying to learn who you are now in our discussion. And hopefully you'll learn a little bit about me too. But I want to learn. I don't want to judge. I want to understand. And I think that's one of the problems we have today. We don't have people who want to understand.
Oh,
you can have
I
one idea, and I might not agree with it. But then maybe if we talk, maybe I'll sense a semblance of rationality in you, and maybe you'll sense a little bit of rationality in me.
Oh,
and
I couldn't agree more.
That's all I'm looking for.
I don't. I'm open to having a discussion with anyone who comes at it like you do, you know, wanting to learn. And I have talked to a lot of folks over the years. I've been doing this for more than 10 years. I've talked to gun control groups and went in and attended their meetings and gotten booed a couple of times. But you know what? What I won't do is debate, because like I said earlier, the debate ended in 1791. But I will educate gladly and talk all day long. And I'll also, and I've done this frequently because as an instructor, a firearms instructor, I believe it's part of my job, part of my responsibility to introduce new people to the sport. So I have taken a lot of people who to the range that have never shot before. And I've taken a few people to the range that were pretty much diametrically opposed to guns. And you know what everybody had in common is everybody had a great time.
Well, you know, you bring up a very good point. The people that you've introduced, let's say, to clay shooting or going after pheasant in the wild or whatever, the point is, these are not murderers. Aren't there aberrations to every aspect and every part of society? So are we going to demonize everybody because somebody murdered somebody and they didn't even have a gun rightfully that they acquired? I mean, are the numbers skewed? I mean, do we look at people who believe in the Second Amendment, more people getting killed who belong to the Second Amendment Foundation as opposed to people getting killed in Chicago or New York?
Not even close. And, you know, you bring up a
really
good point.
Why don't we hear that?
You bring up a good point about the data. I mean, there are groups out there that, like the gun violence, there's a gun violence group, and they skew the numbers. And according to them, there have been like 600 mass shootings this year. FBI has it at around 30, because, you know, you play with the definitions of what constitutes a mass shooting. Gun Violence Archive is the name of the group, and they believe that anytime four or more people are shot, it's a mass shooting. So the gang violence in Chicago constitutes a mass shooting. A horrible domestic act would constitute a mass shooting. But for most people, most of your listeners, when they think about a mass shooting, they picture in their head some crazy guy walking through the halls of a school or a shopping mall shooting people at random. And that's pretty much the definition the FBI uses. But, you know, the Gun Violence Archive says there's been 619 of them. So what number does the legacy media, the mainstream media, use? They use the big scary number because it gets clicks on their stories and it's a more sensational headline. But, you know, and like you said earlier too, they blame the tool. They blame the gun. But when somebody goes and gets all liquored up and gets behind the wheel of a car and drives into a car full of innocent victims, we don't blame the car for that. We blame the operator. And that's, I think, the big shift here, the disconnect.
Well, we don't outlaw the cars, do we? But we're trying to outlaw guns.
Right.
And it's the individual that's the one that's the aberration not the gun. Right. If the gun is left alone, no one's going to shoot it.
Mine are in my
That's
safe right now. They're not going to shoot anybody. They're locked up in some of my safes. But yeah,
right.
And especially, you know, some of that they castigate the ones that have a good tactical purpose, like the AR, because they consider
mm-hmm.
them scary looking. I consider them incredibly ergonomic, lightweight, perfect
mm-hmm.
low recoil, perfect for a female shooter or smaller shooters. You know, they don't understand. You've got people that do not understand firearms trying to regulate firearms. They don't have a clue.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Biden's recent aborted nominee to run the ATF. He couldn't define what a quote-unquote assault weapon is when asked in the Senate
mm-hmm.
confirmation hearing. Very famous. Couldn't come up with it, but, you know, a workable definition. And again, they're blaming the device, not the operator.
Well, you know, I'm originally born in Israel, and I had a gun by my side at all times.
Of course.
And I don't think that if you look at the number of incidences around in Israel, and I'm now 72 years old, I can guarantee you we never had an incident in which somebody killed somebody that had nothing to do with police work or any military work. I mean, some people say, well, there are some people today have been killed by police, security police, whatever. But in all the years that I was there, we didn't have that. So nobody went berserk either and all of a sudden picked up a gun and shot somebody in a family or somebody in a kibbutz or in the city. It was just unheard of.
It's a great model. I mean, I had a picture up on my wall for the longest time of Israeli elementary school kids out playing in recess.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a teacher
mm-hmm.
standing there with an Uzi slung over her shoulder. And while that's shocking
yeah.
to some people, I think that's brilliant. Now, if she doesn't need
it was
to
a
use
reality.
It. Yeah. If she doesn't need
but
to use
doesn't.
It and nobody threatens the kids, what's wrong with having that there? Nothing.
Well, that's the point. So are we doing enough to make sure that people who do get guns are mentally sane? Are there things that we could do better with that regard? But then how is it that we permit people who don't get a legal firearm, how is it that they're permitted to carry it? And why don't we stop the illegal guns from coming into the country or being disseminated in the country?
Well, we are all for background checks. I mean, I go through a background check
mm-hmm.
every single time I buy a firearm. It's really no big deal, you know. And there are enough laws on the books to stop plenty of folks. But we get right back to what we talked about earlier. These guys that are carrying guns illegally do so because they know if they get caught, there'll be little to no penalty. So until we start enforcing that and saying, hey, you're going to go be a guest of the state for 5 to 10 years because you're a prohibited person carrying a concealed firearm, or you're going to be charged
mm-hmm.
federally with your firearms crime, they're just going to continue because they know it's a slap on the wrist and they'll be out of jail within 5 to 10 minutes, damn near.
Well, that's a problem, though, because, you know, it costs an absolute fortune of people incarcerated. So
oh, it does.
Is that why we're doing it? Because it's cheaper to let them go than to spend $50,000 a year to keep them in prison?
There has to be some type of penalty because they're freewheeling it right now with little regard for the law.
Mm.
And a law that's not enforced or is enforced but has no penalty is not a law. It's a joke.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I like
your
Israeli analogy. I know friends that have gone to visit Israel and the Holy Land, and at first they were struck by the fact that you've got off-duty IDF folks carrying a rifle around wherever they go. And you know, after a while, they all said, yeah, that's a pretty comforting feeling, really. You've got a guy or a gal who's trained in how to use this weapon. They've got access to it. Pretty good feeling.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember when I was younger, we didn't have it was expensive to travel, including on buses, and everybody used to, they used the term, they tramped, you know, like being a tramp, and you would put your finger out and try to get a free ride somewhere, and people would stop and they ask you where you want to go, and if they go in that direction, then they'll take you and your gun and they'll drop you off. But there was
Perfect.
No fear, my God, that somebody was going to kill you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what's wrong with having a trained IDF soldier in your car who's very, very well trained and very well armed? I mean, that's not a bad feeling at all.
Well, maybe that's the thing. You see, if you pick up a soldier and the person might do that might also have a gun in the car because they're also a soldier, because everybody's a soldier in Israel, including the women. And so the bottom line is nobody shoots each other.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem to happen. We don't have murders like that.
Because they're a tool there.
It's a tool. That's right. Yeah, so very, very interesting. So maybe that's the direction America will eventually go. Everybody will carry a gun, and they'll all be licensed, and everybody will know, you know, about them before they get the gun. And maybe we'll become civil at that point. I have no idea.
Well, I've always
said... Who knows?
Said,
maybe Israel will become an aberrant state. You never can tell. You know,
things
will go right away.
An armed society is a polite society. Trust me on that.
Yeah, I think so, too. Unbelievable. Well, I am so thankful that you made the time for us. I hope I didn't scare you and that you
Not
might
at all.
Consider coming back.
Anytime,
there's always something to learn.
I got to tell you, I've enjoyed this conversation immensely. I speak on behalf of the Second Amendment Foundation quite often, but I got to tell you, this is one of the more enjoyable conversations I've had in quite a while, sir.
Well, did you think it was going to be adversarial? Because I hate that.
Not at all.
I don't like adversarial discussion.
I don't either.
I'm just hoping that discussion, it's a discussion. It's not even an interview. It's not an introspection. It's like, I'll try to explain myself to you and you try to explain yourself to me and hopefully we'll understand each other.
Absolutely.
And
it was
respect
a fun
the fact
talking.
That you may agree one way and I may agree another.
Perfect.
But we also shut people off. That's the problem too.
Yeah.
So I'm never going to resolve it. I'm too old to change.
Never, never.
Well, anyway, thank you so much. All the best to you. Have a Merry Christmas if we don't speak beforehand, and much success. Take care.
And to you, sir. You take care. I really enjoyed this.
Be
Thank
well.
You very much for the opportunity.
My pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
Take care.
Oh, how exciting. It doesn't get more exciting when you can speak to someone who's lucid and understands what they're talking about and has an understanding, a comprehension of what's happening, and can contend with issues that might be deleterious on one hand, but also be emboldening on another. And it's very encouraging. I think I think we have to focus more attention to that. I think I've been doing this for quite a while, but I think we have to emphasize that we want to learn in order to become knowledgeable and aware. And you never know, maybe the discussion and becoming engaged with other people who you may think have a different concept than you may actually not have that much of a difference in concept from you, or that you'll be able to appreciate where they come from and also question where you're coming from and vice versa. I think we need to just be introspective and also sensitive to what others have to say. And if we do so in our discourse with others, then maybe that will be the respect that we can show one another may actually bring us to a better understanding. So that's the story for us today. I'm going to go back to our studio screen and wish you a good day. And I'm going to get going because I've got an appointment in order to meet somebody for lunch. And then I also have to do some other stuff at the drugstore. Oh, it's going to be a fun day. So all the best to you guys. Take care and be well. Bye.